You may recall that I suggested to you some years ago that Cleveland was perhaps one of the best kept secrets in the nation. This is no longer the case. A scarred and ugly image of our city has been messaged across the length and breadth of the United States. When we spoke of Cleveland to others, we often described it as a not very exciting place in which to live, but a good home, a good place to raise up our children. How did you explain Murray Hill to your children? There are two Clevelands, one of which we are very proud. We prayed about it. Our stately suburbs, the brick, the building of our cultural center, the proud history of our voluntary welfare agencies. And another Cleveland, a Cleveland we contrive to maintain invisible. How many of you see the welfare client picking up his pitifully inadequate public assistance check? Another Cleveland which we contrive to keep invisible. How long has it been since you've walked in the Huff area and seen at first hand its raw and restless, and I almost said hopeless, poverty? You may cross the Cuyahoga River every day, but do you see it for what it is? Cleveland's racial wall. Negroes to the east, no Negroes to the west. Now, what I am saying to you is not oratory born out of an emotional reaction to the crisis of the hour. I would recall to you some paragraphs I spoke more than 2 years ago from this very pulpit. The first glorious page of Cleveland's history revealed a dedication to free public education of high quality. Today, good education is still to be had thanks to the sacrificial integrity of a noble profession. But education is no longer a focus of civic energy. I asked myself, where are the graduates of our Cleveland schools of 25 years ago? By and large, they have turned their backs on their alma maters, gone out and founded new schools, less crowded, less colorful schools. Where do we find these graduates? All too often, I am afraid that they are to be found financing campaigns against the passage of city school levies and grumbling about the high cost of owning property in the city which nourished them and from which they have fled. We once prided ourselves on our record of sympathetic and enlightened help to the less fortunate, to the new immigrant, to those of other colors and of other colored skins. Can we still claim the mantle of charity in a community which allots only 80% minimum subsistence to its welfare cases? So well did I preach and so effectively that we now allot 70% of minimum need. Can we who insist that artificially drawn municipal lines determine who shall pay the burden of welfare preen ourselves on our social vision, on our citizenship? What does our present fragmented tax structure ensure? The cynic would answer with some measure of truth, only that the poor must pay poor relief, while the wealthy escape that burden. The mother, Cleveland, has been virtuous. The mother has been kind. She gave us schools and parks and recreational facilities and a fine economic climate. But I wonder if we, the children, have been grateful in measure for our bounty. The cycle of life in Cleveland has been centrifugal, outward. We have slammed the door on the home, picked up our baggage, walked out without looking back. Today, as many of us live outside the city line as within it. This mass exodus has been typical of every major city, but in Cleveland we have raised the pace of this exodus to the nth degree. It is not at all impossible, and indeed it is quite routine, for many of us to be of our city, but never to enter it. There is a wall in Cleveland quite as high and quite as impenetrable as the wall which divides Berlin. We are today citizens of a divided city, one half well-fed, well-housed, well-educated, the other half suffering a crisis in welfare. The one half boasting the richest suburb in the nation, the other suffering with 1 in 50 of its citizens requiring economic or medical assistance. The one glutted, the other impoverished. The one building swimming pools, the other lacking classrooms. What was the picketing and the freedom singing and the sit-in all about? It was a desperate cry for the half of Cleveland which we keep invisible. See me! Acknowledge my presence! See me not as a welfare statistic, but as a mother concerned with the educational quality of her child's training. See me not as an hourly rated worker whom you hire from 8 to 5, but as a father, intimately concerned with the well-being of his family, with its decency. A father would far prefer to have his children playing in green grass than on gray asphalt. If we have eyes and we see not, and ears but we hear not, if we use these people but do not consider them, then they must resort to the headlines, to the singing, to the picketing, to the sit-in, to be heard. They must shake us awake, for they too have a claim on a part of the prosperity, a part of the privilege, a part of the promise of our city. What happened in Cleveland last week was something far deeper, far more profound than a citywide concern with the placement of some 800 Negro children in 3 largely white receiving schools. To see the issue largely in these narrow and restricted terms is to misunderstand it. For the placement of these children, however misguided and morally indefensible, would not explain how half a city was aroused to anger and to bitter passion. What we saw last week was the emergence of the Negro to the sun. What we heard was the voice of the Negro Revolution. What we heard was a voice which will not be stilled. We heard was a voice which will be shouted from the rooftops until we listen. For it is a demand, and a proper demand, that as human beings, as citizens, created by God, they have their rights to decency and dignity, to hope, and to a future. The issue in Cleveland was broadly racial. What happened at Collingwood was ugly and foreboding and racial. What happened in Murray Hill was vicious and violent and racial. What happened on the 3rd floor of the school board building was determined and even fanatic and racial. Racial unrest, racial tension was the match that lit the fuse. But again, I think we mistake the context of last week's events if we see them purely in terms of a racial confrontation. When the United Freedom Movement made its presentation to our school board late in the summer of last year, they were able to locate a few overt and covert areas in which the school system of Cleveland was guilty of having gone along with existing patterns of segregation. If the children who had been bussed into Brett and Memorial and Murray Hill schools had been white, no one surely in the school system would have devised the policy of sequestration. If some of our fine labor unions did not have racial bars for admission, the vocational training program at the Max Hayes High School would not be of limited value to Negro students. And it is true also that the textbooks which are used in our public school system should reflect more accurately the cross-section, the realities of a megalopolis, and not the sweet, all-white boy, girl, and dog single-family house living of suburbia. The school board agreed to make the necessary changes. The school board agreed in September, on the last day of September, to appoint a citizens' community relations group to investigate any further areas in which the system may be guilty of having cooperated with Cleveland prejudice. But none of these issues in and of themselves are of sufficient size and dimension to explain what happened last week. We saw the pickets. But did you bother to read the picket boards? The picket boards said, some of them, integrate Murray Hill School, integrate Brett or Memorial Schools. But as many of them, in fact, far more, said, end all ghetto schools. And Hazeldale is the ghetto school, not Brett, not Memorial. There was implicit on these placard boards an attack on the entire structure of our Cleveland school system. Indeed, I would submit to you that what we saw last week was a vote of no confidence by the Negroes of this city in our Cleveland public school system. What they were saying is precisely what the PACE report said a year ago. The quality of education in the Cleveland public school district is steadily declining. What the Negro parents were saying was that you are not providing for my children a sufficient leg up, a sufficient educational opportunity to prepare them adequately for life in this metropolitan area 10 years hence. We vote no confidence. Our children need more than you are giving them. Our children require a better education than you are yet providing. I heard many of you say last week, what are the Negroes complaining about? Glenville was a ghetto school. Glenville was entirely of our people. We never picketed the school board. We never complained about it. We are quite proud that Glenville won most of the honors and academics in the state. But I suggest to you that Glenville 25 years ago was a far different school than it is today. The ratio of teachers to pupils has lessened. The amount of real money available for instructional purposes is less, significantly less. And education is not so easy in Glenville today as it was 25 years ago. The children do not come from upwardly mobile, educationally motivated homes. Many of them need counseling and guidance. And much of that counseling and guidance is not available to them. The state of Ohio estimates that it requires a school district budget of $500 per child per year adequately to educate the child. In some of our suburban areas, we spend $700 and more per child per year. In the Cleveland public school system, we can budget but less than $400. The state of Ohio recommends that there be 50 professionals for every 1,000 children in a school system. In some of our favorite school districts, there are 60 professionals, and sometimes more. There are 39 in the Cleveland Public School District. Indeed, the Cleveland Public Schools would be providing a far worse education than they are today were it not for the devotion and the dedication and competence of many selfless school administrators and teachers. For what is at fault is an inadequate budget. We have starved the school system for years. We have not allowed it to do what it knows it must do. Increase the quality of its educational program, increase the effectiveness of its curricula, increase the personal contact with the child. The statistics do not reveal the whole sad story. In some of our Cleveland public school districts, 90% and more of the children in a given school come from what is known as a culturally deprived home. There is no place in that home for homework study. There is no educational motivation. There are no books. The parents are probably semi-literate if they are together at all. In some of our Cleveland neighborhood schools, 90% of the children who begin a semester will not be in the same class with the same teacher at the end of the semester. These children require special tutoring. They require individual help. They require vocational guidance, reading rehabilitation. It is estimated they require an expenditure of $200 per child per year above the $500 already suggested. Not a single cent of this money is available to the Cleveland public school system. The children who require the most have the least. And that is the cruelty of education in Cuyahoga County today. And that is the reason for the crisis of the last week. And it is for that reason that I would make this proposal. The Cleveland Chamber of Commerce, and the various landlord and real estate boards of our community, and the United Freedom Movement join with the school board, either in May or in November of this year, to promote and to effect not only a renewal of an inadequate levy, but the passage of a levy which would permit the school system to supplement what already is in existence and to provide superior education. Why the Cleveland Chamber of Commerce? Because business cannot thrive in an unsettled and roiling situation. Because it is high time that the chamber and the interests which it represents recognize that Cleveland is something more than buildings and railroads and banks, that it is people, that people are our basic resource. Why the landlords and the real estate interests? Because for too long now, the representatives of these groups have been able to veto any major improvement in school levies, such as the political configuration of our city, the elderly and the parochial of interest. But these groups have had the balance of power, and they have been able to go down to the school board time and again and to say, this you do not need, this is frill, this is unnecessary. This program is not required. Now is the time for these groups which draw their income from the city to replenish the basic resource of the community. And why the United Freedom Movement? Because it is wise for the Negro to not only to challenge and to confront, but to cooperate. Because realistically, if such a levy could not pass with a high plurality in the heavy Negro wards, it could not pass at all. But most important of all, because it is essential that the Negro recognize that his fate, his emergence, is integrally bound up with the success and the development of public education in Cleveland. As you know, there are militant groups in the civil rights movement which have already taken the position the various large metropolitan school districts must bus and move about pupils until an arbitrary and theoretical integration percentage exists in every school. So many whites and so many Negroes. End the ghetto schools. Destroy the concept of the neighborhood school. An already straitened school budget could hardly pay the freight for bus rental and for gasoline. It would be a tragedy if it had to do so. But it is an appealing concept to parents whose children are in largely Negro schools, who look about them at a public school system where the white schools, the neighborhood white schools, are a slight cut above, and they are. The white areas are less crowded. 23,000 people are crowded into a square mile around East Tech. 6,000 people are in the square mile around John Marshall. The teachers who are in the largely white schools tend to remain in the school system. The teachers who are in the largely Negro schools with a high percentage of children in their classrooms, with a high turnover, where they see the pathology of education, often find the allure of a position in the suburbs more than they can give up. An assistant administrator of public education in Cleveland estimated for me that the Cleveland public school system must replace its entire teaching staff every 4 years. And the highest rate of professional turnover exists in these Negro ghetto neighborhood schools. The appeal to end the neighborhood schools is an alluring one. And the more militant of the Negro leaders are prepared to say that they are willing to play the part of Samson, to pull down the entire educational enterprise around their heads and ours, because they say that is the only way that you, will understand the depth of our anger and the depth of our determination. I tend to agree with Dr. Kenneth Clark, a Negro civil rights leader, professor of psychology at the City College of New York, who insists that priority now must be given not to some theoretical integration of schools, but to the development of superior education within the existing neighborhood schools. But I would say to you that the time for this improvement was yesterday. And I would make this prediction, that unless we in Cleveland succeed in significantly and substantially improving the quality, reversing the trend of education in our city within 3 years, there will be such confusion, picketing and boycotts and crisis and anger, that the minimum level of efficiency which we have maintained will disappear, and that the entire educational enterprise would be in danger. The hour is late. I wonder if we recognize the lateness of the hour. And what of us? What of us who live outside the city school district? I would suggest that we initiate in each of our school districts an annexation petition. Its purpose, to allow our school district to be annexed by the city of Cleveland. Surely the city can use our abundance. Surely the city can take full advantage of our fine teaching staffs. I am not so naive as to believe that these petitions would be successful. But surely as we bethink our concern with educational quality for our children, we will be less tempted to criticize the strategy or the timing or the tactics of the Negro group as it struggles with inadequacy, with indifference, to win for its children not quality, but decency, not a superior education, but an adequate education. I am tired of the prejudiced who said, what happened last week happened because of outside agitators, communists. I'm tired of the queasy who said, if only the police had acted with greater decisiveness. I'm tired of the morally uncertain who have said, if only the ministers hadn't picketed. The truth is that Murray Hill was inevitable, like the fate of a Greek tragedy. It did not have to happen there and then and in that way, but it had to happen. And Murray Hill will happen again and again and again. Until you and I re-knit a fragmented city, There are 32 school districts in Cuyahoga County. 31 of them exist as counter districts to that of the city. There are 104 governing bodies in Cuyahoga County. 103 of them exist because of people who turned their back and who fled and who feared the city. We cannot exist twain, two cities, pulled apart. One surfeited, the other guttered. One full of plenty, the other full of bitterness. As long as that separation exists, Cleveland will be a city of increasing violence. For make no mistake about it, though you enlist another Negro in your lodge or in your club, though you welcome a Negro couple into your home for an afternoon tea, though you listen patiently and nod that you too agree with the Negro aim of integration and of equality, this is not the answer. The answers now are structural and political and economic. They require major changes in our way of life. They will not be made easily. The forces of evil are strong and they are close to the surface. But what Cleveland requires now is a sturdy leadership. What Cleveland requires now is an understanding. The issues have hardly been met. All week long, the line with which Voltaire captioned the last chapter of his novel Candide ran through my mind, a conclusion in which nothing is concluded. The racial crisis in Cleveland has just begun. 30-40 years of turning the back, cold shouldering, of moving away, of building outside, is bearing fruit. The invisible city, the city we kept hidden so long, insists to be seen. It will be heard. We can, prayerfully, achieve a better tomorrow by evolution, by political means. I opt for that solution. But violence is close to us. And simply assenting, agreeing to be agreeable, is no longer enough. We need votes. We need action. We need metropolitan government. We need all those programs which have been spoken at city club forums and from this pulpit for so long. And we need them now, today, not after they've been studied again. Cleveland is the most over-researched city in the United States. We need them now. And we can establish them cooperatively. For at base, and this is our one hope, at base, the racial crisis need not separate our city. Both white and Negro require decent education. Both white and Negro require a healthy employment situation. Both white and Negro require stable neighborhoods. And decent housing, and excellent and effective zoning restrictions. We can cooperate for these basic city ends, and far better that cooperation than that we separate ourselves into gangs of hooligans who will come together in violence, who can be separated only by the police. The time is now, and the hour is late.